Thank you very much, Mustafa, and thank you, David, for inviting me. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here in such a cold weather. I have come from Islamabad, where the weather was in the 50s, and people were still complaining of cold. I think they should be sent here to know what cold weather means. This is my second trip to Edmonton, and I'm very happy to be here. It's a wonderful city, wonderful people. David has been a wonderful host, very gracious, very generous. First, let me say that I miss greatly my very dear friend and David's friend, Ibrahim Abu Rabi. Many of you probably know him and miss him as much as I do. May Allah bless his soul and reward him abundantly for all the good things that he did in his life. Let me begin by making a few preliminary and general remarks. I don't know, I'm not a very technically savvy person. I don't know how to turn off power. I think it's now turn off. Thank you. Let me begin by making some general remarks and statements, and then I will substantiate them in the course of my presentation. First of all, the laws in Pakistan Penal Code that pertains to what we call blasphemy were first introduced by the British, not by the Pakistani government, in the late 19th century, early 20th century. What the Pakistanis did was to add more sting and bite to these laws in the course of time. Secondly, there had been absolutely no demand for any law relating to blasphemy during the first four decades after the independence of Pakistan. So it became only a matter of public discourse during the 1980s. Until 80s, nobody talked about it. Thirdly, the prime motive, and this is my argument, behind the blasphemy legislation in the 1980s and the 1990s was politics rather than some new theological discoveries by the ulama. And fourthly, despite the fact that the blasphemy laws were originally targeted against the Ahmadis in Pakistan, you probably know all of them who Ahmadis are, and obviously all these laws were discriminatory against the minorities, majority of those who have been charged with blasphemy so far have been Muslims. Not Ahmadis, not Christians, not Hindus. Fifthly, in overwhelming majority of blasphemy cases, the session court, the local court, at the local level, convicts the accused and sentences them to death, because death is the mandatory punishment. A judge cannot give less than death penalty. Invariably, the high courts acquit the accused. That's a very interesting phenomenon. The lower courts convict the accused, give them the death penalty, and the high court acquits them. It is not probably well known outside Pakistan that not a single person has been executed on blasphemy charges in Pakistan so far. Touch the wood. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. In every single case, the higher court have acquitted the accused for lack of sufficient evidence. Now, these are some of the general observations that I thought that we should begin with. The blasphemy laws of Pakistan Penal Code have long been debated inside Pakistan and outside Pakistan because of their discriminatory intent against the religious minorities and also for violating freedom of religion. But unlike Christianity, the concept of blasphemy in Islam does not denote infidelity. It also does not denote any dissent against religious authorities or even a major departure from orthodoxy. These are very interesting things if you compare with Christian concept of blasphemy, in which case, over time, in case of Islam, if you depart from the orthodox understanding of Islam, over a period of time, you can be recognized as a legitimate Islamic sect. As happened in the case of the Shiites, Ismailis, Bohras, Zaydis, and many other sects, who are now considered a legitimate part of the Muslim Ummah, Muslim community, and legitimate sects of Islam, not blasphemers. Rather, it is the what is known in the Christian West, blasphemy in Islam, probably the comparable formulation is intentional ridicule or malicious speech or action against the sacred, especially against the person of Prophet Muhammad. But there are a few interesting things, pertinent things to note here. One, there is no comparable term for blasphemy in any of the Islamic languages, not in Arabic, not in Persian, not in Urdu, not in Turkish. It is primarily a Judeo-Christian import into the modern Islamic discourse. The classical jurists only talked about the deliberate contempt of the Prophet Muhammad, and they used terms like sab, which means insult, istihza, like scoffing, mocking, sukhriya, and shatam. Shatam means abusing the Prophet. Second, the cases in Islamic history of what we call blasphemy today have been few and far between. I'm not a specialist in the history of the Arab world, but looking at the 600 years of Muslim rule in India, there is not a single reported case of blasphemy in Muslim India. Isn't that interesting? Neither at the level of the state, nor at the level of the public jurist, private jurist. Third, there is no legal injunction in the Quran, and this is quite interesting. And probably these are some of the things that are not very well known among the outside the specialist scholars. There is no legal injunctions in the Quran against blasphemy, period, either against God or against the Prophet. Unlike, for example, the specific legal injunctions against such crimes as adultery, theft, highway robbery, acquisition, false acquisition of adultery, and drinking of wine, for example. There are references, however, in the Quran that promise punishment only in the hereafter to those who mock and insult and disobey God and His Prophet once the truth has been revealed. But there is no legal injunctions in the Quran saying that if somebody does that, he should be killed or he should be punished. The entire theological and legal argument advanced by the religious leaders today and the ulama in favor of death penalty and other punishment for blasphemy are based on hadith literature. Hadith means the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad, and on the inferences derived from this literature by the classical jurists and the ulama. But even here, neither the entire corpus of hadith nor the entire juristic literature represent any consensus. There are traditions reported from Prophet Muhammad according to which he authorized the killing of a person, a death penalty for a person who abused him. And then there are traditions according to which he admonished his companions who wanted to administer the punishment to somebody who had abused him. Similarly, there is no consensus among the jurists on what constitutes blasphemy. What are its parameters? Does it come under the had or tazir? Had is a punishment that has been specified in the Quran. Tazir is a punishment that is left at the discretion of a judge. So in the Quran, and among the jurists, there has been differences of opinion. Where does blasphemy fall? Does it come under had or does it come under Tazi? And then there is a question, will the punishment be the same for a Muslim blasphemer and a non-Muslim? Who is authorized to administer the punishment? The state authorities or any one private individual can take up the law in his own hand and kill the accused on the spot? And finally, can the accused be pardoned if he apologizes or if he offers his sincere repentance? As we all know that Sunni Islam has four orthodox school of law: Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi, Hanbali, and then the Shiites have the Jafri school of law. As in many other cases, the classical jurists have differed on the questions that I have mentioned earlier. Contrary to the general impression that there is a single consensual position of all jurists on this issue, the fact is that it has always been a widely contested terrain in the past and remains contested even today among Muslim scholars and theologians. So, what I have said so far, there is no mention in the Quran of any legal injunctions against blasphemy. The literature, Hadith literature, has contradictory reports, and the juristic literature, which constitutes the basis of Islamic Sharia today, it has no consensus. The jurists differ. Let me, at this point, in parentheses, express my strong bias against modernity. It's modernity, basically, that envisages the standardization and homogenization of laws, right? And it is the modernity that has led to the strict codification of otherwise free-floating and open-ended interpretations of Sharia. You see, before the modern encounter of Islamic people, Muslim people, with modernity, Sharia was a free-floating, open to interpretation, discretionary authority of the judges, of the ulama, of the jurists, of the fuqaha, and they can pick and choose from among the various interpretations that were available to them. Come modernity and you codify the law, you restrict the law, and you have one size fit all. And that is what seems to have happened. Sharia laws in some Muslim societies have now been codified. You see, as I said, before the advent of modernity, the qadis, the Muslim judges and jurists, were free to use their discretion in administering Sharia injunctions, taking into account the specific circumstances of the crime, the personal history of the accused, and the consequences of the act on society in general. Also, they would award the punishment on the basis of all these considerations. This would help them pick and choose from a wide range of interpretations and all valid and Islamically legitimate in specific cases. After the advent of modernity and codification, you have now tied the hands of the judges and the jurists with procedural restrictions and mandatory punishments. What did you do? You chose one interpretation from amongst the dozens of different interpretations and you standardized them. And violating basically the Prophet's famous saying that the differences of interpretation in my ummah are a blessing of God. Ikhtalafi ummah rahman, something. The blessing of the differences of opinion in my ummah, my community, is a blessing of God. In the blasphemy cases reported in juristic literature, judges and jurists would make, in classical period, a clear distinction between an individual act of indiscretion, on the one hand, and a willful, deliberate and organized campaign to vilify the sacred symbols of Islam on the other. There's a great deal of difference. An individual act of discretion, on the one hand, that is forgivable. Okay? That can be ignored. Indiscretion. Maybe in some unguarded moment, you say something stupid. And then say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. That's the end of it. What the jurists were seriously concerned in the classical period was an organized, deliberate campaign over a long period of time to vilify the sacred symbols of Islam. And when you establish this fact, then you are not punishing an individual. You are punishing a group of individuals for disrupting the social order, for the treason against the state. And that goes beyond blasphemy. This is what the Quran calls fitna. Fitna, disruption of society, creating conditions of chaos in society where normal life becomes impossible. Now, going back to the question of what happened in Pakistan in terms of the legislation of laws. The Pakistan Penal Code, with PPC, includes an independent chapter. It's called Chapter 15, dealing with offenses relating to religion, which consists of four sections, 295, 296, 297, 298, and every leader of religious minorities in Pakistan have memorized these sections because they are the victims of that. The Chapter 15 deals with injuries or defiling places of worship with intent to insult the religion of any cross, disturbing religious assembly, trespassing the burial places of religious communities, and uttering words with deliberate intent to injure religious feeling. These laws were introduced in 1860 under the Indian Penal Code during the British period. But they were basically law and order instruments. The British were not much concerned about the religious feeling, sanctity of one group against the other. Basically, they didn't want any disturbance of peace. So all the laws that were introduced during the British period, they were instruments for law and order developed by the colonial settler regime to ensure that there is peace in the empire rather than protection of any religious ideology. Then the new sections were added at various stages, not only during the British period, but also after independence in 1947, in order to cope with the situation resulting out of the growing religious sensitivities of various communities. In 1927, an amendment about deliberate and malicious acts intended to outrage religious feelings of any cross by insulting its religion and religious beliefs was introduced to widen the scope of the chapter by the British. It was in 1982 that Section 295B was added, in which life imprisonment was enacted for defiling, damaging, or desecrating the Holy Quran willfully or with malintention. The three sections were added in 1984 again, about use of derogatory remarks in respect of holy persons and misuse of epithets or descriptions and titles reserved for certain holy persons or places. This was targeted against the Ahmadis, 1984. Because the Ahmadis, who were declared non-Muslims by Mr. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto in 1974, continued to call themselves as Muslims. And they continued to call their places of worship as mosque. They continued to call their leader as Khalifa. And they continued to call the companions of their caliph as Sahaba, which in Islamic tradition you only call the companions of the Prophet Muhammad as Sahaba. So a law was passed, it was a ridiculous law during Ziaul-Haq's time, passed, in which it prohibited the Ahmadis that you cannot call yourself Muslim, you cannot call your place of worship as masjid, as a mosque. And you cannot use any of the Islamic descriptions and epithets that we Muslims use. Like the Malaysian government has recently has been doing, they have prohibited Christians and non-Muslims using the word Allah for their God. Look at the kind of absurdity and the stupidity. Allah is an Arabic word for God. And before the advent of Islam, the Arabs called their God as Allah. And if you read the Christian Bible and the Hebrew Bible in Arabic, it is Allah. And how can, I mean, is it conceivable that the Canadian government would pass a law in saying that Muslims cannot use the word God because God is our God? Okay. But these are some of the things that did happen. And finally, finally then, the Parliament enacted the Criminal Law Amendment Act, number 3 of 1986, adding section 295C. That is the central controversial section. And note that the title of the act is not Blasphemy Act of 1986. It is called, the title is Use of Derogatory Remarks in Respect of the Holy Prophet. There is no such law in Pakistan with the title of Blasphemy Act. Now, and this 295C reads, and I will quote, "Whoever by words, either spoken or written, or by visible representation, or by any imputation, innuendo, or insinuation, directly and indirectly, defiles the sacred name of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, shall be punished with death or imprisonment for life, and shall also be liable to fine." Unquote. And then as an explanation, the act says, quote, "The word defile occurring in the section means, quote, to corrupt purity or perfection of, to debase, to make ceremonially unclean, to pollute, to sully, to violate the sacredness or sanctity of, to desecrate, profane, to sully the honor of, and to dishonor," unquote. Don't you think that they must have consulted at least 4 or 5 different theses, Rogers and Rendemouse and Webster and Oxford, in order to come up with all those synonyms? I think the drafters of this law were quite familiar. Now, in 1990, what happens is that some religious leaders and some private citizens, primarily motivated and inspired by some of the religious leaders who were already in the forefront of anti-Ahmadis, they challenged the new law in the Federal Sharia Court. This was the court that was established during Zia-ul-Haq's time. It's a federal court that decides whether any law is according to the law of Sharia or not. They challenged this law in Sharia court, basically saying that this section 295C should not have given the option to the court to choose between the death penalty and life imprisonment. And the life imprisonment must be made mandatory because this is what Sharia says. The court declared in its judgment that the alternative punishment of imprisonment for life for the crime of insulting the Prophet and defiling the sacred name is violation of the injunction of Sharia. Why did the court do so? Because there were two orthodox ulama who were serving as members of the Federal Sharia courts, and the three other judges who were the secular judges, they were so intimidated by those ulama that they just signed on the judgment initially written by these two ulama. But then the court also added that the words sounding contemptuous of the Prophet are not an offense until they are based on malicious action or intent. And here is an exact quote from the judgment of that court. It's very important. The meaning and import of words differ from place to place, the court said. Again, context may also suggest different meanings. The accused, therefore, must be allowed an opportunity to explain lest an innocent person is punished. Right of an accused to explain his conduct cannot be taken away. It is therefore only after the explanation by the accused that the court can decide whether the words so said were intended to malign, were they used maliciously and contemptuously, or were uttered innocently. Unquote. Now, what does the Parliament do? It ignores all the precautionary qualifications mentioned in the court's judgment. It also ignores the court's recommendation that in order to prevent the frivolous and malicious blasphemy accusations by individuals for the purpose of settling personal vendetta, the false accuser should also be given the same punishment. That's what the court also said. The government of the current Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, who was the Prime Minister at that time, in order to win the support of the religious political parties in the Parliament, he introduces the amendment bill, which the Parliament passes in 1992 to incorporate death sentence as the only punishment for this crime. That's what happens. Here is where the politics play a major role. After the whole scale but largely ineffective and ceremonial Islamization by General Zia during the 1980s, the religious political parties and ulama seem to have been disarmed. Why? Because there was nothing left for them to demand from the state in terms of Islamization. Zia had already obliged them on every single demand that they had presented to him. In other words, they were out of business. They were looking for some new issue to stage a comeback in politics. And the blasphemy issue was emotionally charged, popular issue that would help them to find a niche in Pakistan political process. On the other hand, similarly, after the overthrow of Benazir Bhutto's secular government, Nawaz Sharif wanted to establish his Islamic credentials. So it was both imperative for the ulama to bring up the issue of blasphemy, to stay relevant in politics, and it was also imperative for the government, for the state, to establish its Islamic legitimacy. That explains the blasphemy law. No theology, no Sharia, no Islam, no religion. Pure politics, simple. What has happened since, of course, after the introduction of this section 295C, is, to put it mildly, a travesty of justice, both procedural and substantive. Hundreds of people, Muslims, Christians, Ahmadis, Hindus, but mostly Muslims, have been charged with Toheen-e-Quran, insulting the Quran, Toheen-e-Rasool, insulting the Prophet, over the years, and on the complaints of private citizens, private individuals, are by otherwise non-entity mullahs, religious clergy, on personal vendetta, for cheap publicity, or on totally unfounded suspicions. Even though, and that's very important and very interesting to know, at the end of the day, defendant will be acquitted by the higher court. In 100% of the cases, mind you, 100% of the cases, the higher courts have never upheld so far any decision by the lower court. But these acquittals may come after years and years of trials and appeals, while the accused is languishing in jail, where it is very much possible that he may be killed by a fellow jailmate for committing such a heinous crime as blasphemy, as somebody who killed a fellow in his jail, a guy who was accused of blasphemy, and this was a rapist. And what did he say? He said, I may be rapist, but I am a Muslim, and I want to redeem myself by killing you, sinner. And I know that God will forgive all my sins. So, it doesn't help you, even if you are acquitted by the High Court. So, even if they are finally acquitted, their lives are shattered. Their jobs are lost. Their businesses are lost. Their families are stigmatized. Their social life is devastated. Their children are traumatized. And in some cases, especially if you are a Christian, you may flee the country to rebuild your life. If you are lucky, you can get a Canadian visa. Some of them I know. Many of them, not many, but a few dozen of them, were able to get a Canadian visa. Are you relocated somewhere? No one knows you there. Well, if you have, probably you have two other options to commit a suicide. Five of them so far are reported to have committed suicide while the trial was going on. Or to convert to Islam. Four cases have been reported by the Christians, in order to save their lives. He said, La ilaha illallah Muhammad, I have become a Muslim, so you are forgiven. That reminds me, recently I was reading in some newspapers from India, you know, that the election campaign is going on in India these days, and the major political party that is challenging the secular Congress party is the BJP, a Hindu fundamentalist party. And in one of the rallies in which state? Maharashtra, Gujarat state, where Modi, the upcoming prospective prime minister, is from, the butcher of Muslims in Ahmedabad, who killed 2,000 Muslims. There was a rally of the BJP against Muslims, and they were displaying some banners in a Muslim neighborhood, and it says, Jao Kabristan, ya Jao Pakistan. Which means, go to graveyard or go to Pakistan. And a friend of mine said, well, you have not given us some attractive option. I mean, give me some other option. Anyway, so these are the options people have who are convicted of blasphemy, particularly if you are a religious minority. In most cases, the moment you are accused of blasphemy, even before the case is registered by the police, or before it goes to trial, you are most likely to be hounded by the local mob that beats you up, kicks you around to demonstrate its love of Islam, right? Love of the Prophet. And the irony is, and look at that, the irony is that the ulama, the religious leaders in Pakistan, defend the blasphemy law precisely on this ground, saying that if we don't have this law, people will take up on themselves to do the needful. That is, they will kill the accused on the spot. And they believe that this blasphemy law at least gives them some legal protection. The worst thing is that the accused is rarely able to find an attorney to represent himself in the court. Who will dare to defend someone who has been accused of insulting the Prophet? But it's not only the lawyers who feel the public pressure not to defend the blasphemers. The local session judge also has to worry about his own life, about his own safety. After all, a judge of the Lahore High Court, who acquitted a Christian accused of insulting the Prophet on the basis of insufficient evidence, was shot to death outside the court. Why? For not upholding the honor of the Prophet. So, many other session judges today they avoid to take up the cases of blasphemy. And they, because they are worried about their own safety. Now, here just to give you an idea, I'll give you some cases. And they are typical cases. They are not selected as something unique. A 70-year-old mental patient, a British citizen, and this is from this last week's press, and you can go to BBC, Urdu webpage, and you can read. 70-year-old mental patient, a British citizen of Pakistani descent, who has been under psychiatric treatment in Scotland for several years, returns to Pakistan. And occasionally, in his hallucinations, declares himself a prophet. By the way, in his saner moments, he's also asking his tenant to pay the rent that is long past due. That's another issue. That's it. When he's saying. The tenant goes to police and files a case of blasphemy. Yes. Why? You understand? This 70-year-old schizophrenic guy, a friend of mine who is a journalist, he talked to the attorney who is representing the 70-year-old schizophrenic guy. The attorney is a woman, a young woman, very dynamic, very pretty also, I said, yeah. And a friend of mine who journalist, when he talked to this young attorney, she told him that the session judge's reader, it's not a position that you have. Reader is an assistant to the judge, basically, who secretary to the judge. The reader of the judge told the attorney, when she was preparing her case, said, "Betty, my daughter, honey, don't waste your breath. You don't need to prepare the case because the judge at the end of the day is going to give him death penalty. No matter whatever happened to you. But I can guarantee you your client will be acquitted by the higher court. Period." Case number one. Number two. There's a small settlement of huts of a poor Christian community, mostly sweepers and janitors, in a suburb of Islamabad. In a nearby neighborhood, an ambitious imam of a mosque, imam is a prayer leader, has an eye on this Christian settlement where he wants to build a large madrasa. An 8-year-old Christian girl by the name of Misha, who is now in Canada, who is collecting some usable stuff from the street garbage, especially firewood and papers, is one day accused of defiling the pages of the Quran by burning them as fuel. The imam makes the announcement on his mosque loudspeaker, informing his congregation what grave sin has been committed by this silly Christian girl, and asks them to come out of their homes and save Islam from this present and clear danger to their faith. The faithful flock around the imam, who shows them the burnt pages of the Quran, and they surround the Christian neighborhood, shouting for revenge. Luckily, the local police wastes no time, which is rare in Pakistan, and takes the little girl along with her parents in custody. A few days after the incident, an assistant to this mosque imam tells the police that his boss himself burnt the pages of the Quran in order to create hatred against the Christians, making it easier for him to appropriate their land to build this madrasa. Three, there's a sprawling auto parts market in Lahore, monopolized by a few businessmen, just adjacent to the neighborhood populated by small, poor Christian community. The auto parts dealers have long been trying to persuade the Christians to sell their homes, of course, very cheaply, and go somewhere else so that they could expand their business. The Christians refused to oblige, Then one night the entire neighborhood of Christians is set on fire because one of them is heard by someone abusing the prophet. This happened last year in Lahore. Fourth, Shaukat is a Christian in a small town in Punjab. These are all real cases. Is a Christian in small town Punjab teaching math in a high school. Aslam is another teacher, a Muslim, who is teaching math in another town. Aslam wants to be transferred to the school where Shaukat is teaching because he has a girlfriend in that school. One day Aslam approaches Shaukat and asks him for mutual transfer, for which the education department has no objection. If both of us agree, you come to my school, I go to my school, it's called mutual transfer, the department of education is fine. But Shaukat doesn't want to leave the school where he has been teaching for years and which is closer to his home. So he politely declines the offer. What happens next? You guessed it right. A few days after the meeting, Aslam accuses Shaukat of using abusive language against the prophet and produces two witnesses to support his claim. Shaukat loses his job, loses all his life savings to hire an attorney and to feed his family, which has to be relocated somewhere else, languishes in jail for years, and by the time he's freed by the High Court, his life is finished for all practical purposes, and he commits a suicide. After he has been acquitted. Fifth, Iqbal is a devout Muslim and a very successful physician in the province of Sindh. One day when he's awfully busy with his patients, a pharmaceutical company representative shows up, probably to introduce some new medicine that his company has introduced. The doctor tells the secretary to tell the gentleman that he's too busy today and maybe some other day he can see. The rep insists that it will take only a few minutes of the doctor's time. The doctor refuses again to see him. Then suddenly, the rep enters the doctor's office, makes himself comfortable on a chair next to him, opens his briefcase, gives his business card, visiting card to the doctor, and starts explaining the literature about the medicine. The business card he gives is, says, Muhammad Amar, pharmaceutical rep of Glaxo, whatever. Now, the doctor is so upset with this unwelcome guest, he throws the visiting card in the trash can and asks him to leave. What happens next? Again, you guessed it right. The rep files blasphemy case against the doctor for throwing the visiting card with the name of Prophet Muhammad in a trash can. While the doctor even had not looked at the name, Muhammad is a common name. My name is Ahmed, which is Prophet Muhammad's name. Every other person will be Muhammad or Ahmed or Mustafa. So he just said, police comes and he arrests the doctor. He's still in jail. A middle-aged Christian Bowen works as a daily wage laborer, along with a group of Muslim women in an agricultural farm in Punjab. A fellow Muslim woman worker enters into some hot exchange of words with the Christian woman on some trivial issue. And then the Muslim woman accuses the Christian woman of using some abusive language against the prophet. Easy. The Christian woman is arrested by the police, put in jail, pending a trial that never happens. In the meantime, the poor woman languishes in jail for more than a year, and her case attracts attention by the media. The governor of the Punjab province, Mr. Salman Taseer, is outraged with this travesty of justice and issues a public statement expressing his solidarity with this poor Christian woman and calls the blasphemy law a black law. Not only that, he visits the jail and goes and hugs the Christian woman. And he makes an announcement before the media that he will write to the President of Pakistan to pardon the woman because she's innocent. A couple of weeks after that, one of the governor's official guards, his name is Mumtaz Qadri, my name's name, empties his AK-47 on the governor that he was supposed to protect and kills him on the spot in broad daylight outside an Islamabad restaurant. Mumtaz Qadri voluntarily surrenders to the police, saying he has done his religious duty by killing the insulter of the Prophet, Shatam-e-Rasul, because he had called the blasphemy law as the black law. He later tells the police that he was inspired to do this after listening to a Friday sermon by a religious scholar who had called upon his congregation, saying, "Who among you is willing to uphold the honor of your prophet by taking care of this governor who describes the blasphemy law as the black law?" The murdered Mumtaz Qadri receives a hero's welcome when he appears before the court, not only by the religious leaders, but by the members of the bar also, by the lawyers who are supposed to protect the law. The case is a clear first-degree murder case, since Qadri has proudly confessed doing it. But the judge keeps postponing the sentencing. Why? Believing that soon he will be transferred to some other city and he won't be the one to send Qadri to gallows. The last case. A couple of years ago, a well-educated Hindu from Sindh was charged with using abusive language while talking about Prophet Muhammad with his colleagues, in the presence of colleagues in his office, in a private business firm. And he's a very highly educated Hindu gentleman. When this was reported in the media that a highly educated Hindu used this abusive language against the Prophet in the presence of his Muslim colleagues, a friend of mine in Karachi, we were in correspondence, and he sent me an email. He said that this man, a well-educated guy, knowing fully well what happens to those who are accused of blasphemy, if he actually did such a thing, should be either institutionalized for mental illness or should be prosecuted for being dreadfully stupid. He shouldn't be charged for blasphemy. He should be charged for stupidity. I mean, knowing fully well what happened. So these are the kind of just rundown of a few cases. To conclude, from 1986 to 2002, some of the data that 234 lawsuits were filed under blasphemy laws. 51% against Muslims, 22% against Christians, 23% against Ahmadis, and 2% against Hindus. Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, that monitors these data, reports that for 2012, for last year, cases for offenses related to religion were filed against 64 people last year. 46% against Muslims, 50% against Ahmadis. They are the main victims. 3% against Christians. And only 13 people have been convicted of blasphemy during the past 16 years. However, no one has ever been punished, as I stated earlier. Now, let me conclude by making a couple of remarks. Where do we stand now? In my view, there is such a strong pressure from the religious circles in Pakistan on any government, whether it's a military government or an elected government, on this blasphemy issue, that it is inconceivable that Section 295C will be struck down from the Pakistan Penal Code at any time in the near future. No government has the courage to do so. Not legislating an Islamic law is one thing, but to strike down an existing Islamic law will certainly cause such a wrath and fury of the ulama that no government can withstand in Pakistan. It appears that the pressure from the international community, particularly from the Amnesty International, human rights organizations, United States Commission for International Religious Freedom, Canadian government, and all international agencies and all these things, against such laws in Pakistan have further strengthened the resolve of the religious clergy to defend these laws, believing that they are defending their religion against foreign intervention. Who these Christians in the Western countries are to tell us what our Sharia is, or why should we listen to them? This is a clear intervention in our own religious affairs. Now, what can be done? What should we do? The maximum, in my view, that one can expect under the current charged religious atmosphere in Pakistan is that the law is amended to provide at least some legal safeguard to the accused. For example, making the crime bailable. Today, it's not a bailable crime. If you are charged of murder, second-degree murder or manslaughter, you can get a bail. But for this, no bail. So you can amend the law by making it bailable, requirement of a solid evidence before the case goes to formal trial. That can be added. You can amend it for speedy trial. Most important, provision of severe punishment to those who bring in false charges of blasphemy. The leaders of the religious minorities in Pakistan rightly believe that the law is a serious violation of basic human rights. It has unleashed a wild wave of religious fanaticism, and it has caused general scare and sense of security among the religious minorities. Even if you have never been accused of blasphemy, but the sword is always hanging over your head. And it is that psychological environment of general insecurity that is torturous for most of the members of the religious minorities in Pakistan. And many of these leaders now realize, taking into consideration the ground reality of Pakistan's situation, that in the interest of justice and the welfare of minorities, these laws should be amended, providing deterring punishment against all those who abuse the provision of law relating to religion. They also consider the mandatory punishment accompanying the charges as excessive and disproportionate. In fact, some of the Christian leaders, priests, and Christian theologians in Pakistan have come up a better Islamic theological arguments against the death penalty. Basically, arguing from within the Islamic tradition, saying, look, this is what jurists are saying. This is what your hadith is saying, what your Quran is saying. And moreover, the law does not require proof of the actual state of the mind of the person when these things are attributed to him. Finally, there is one other comment that I want to make, which is that religious bigotry and prejudices obviously weigh very heavily in the misuse of these blasphemy laws. But another quite noticeable fact is the socio-economic status of Christians in Pakistan, which is that the differences of caste and urban and rural, rich and poor, are as important as is the question of religious identity. As is well known, an overwhelming majority of Pakistani Christians are descendants of converts from low-caste Hindu communities, many of them known as untouchables in the Hindu socio-religious hierarchy, who were basically consigned to perform low-level menial jobs in society. So, religious bigotry and fanaticism is one factor, but the socio-economic status of the Christian minority is another factor that puts them in a further jeopardy. I haven't seen a single rich urban Christian who has ever been accused of blasphemy, nor a rich Muslim. It's always the poor guy who is accused of all these things. This makes them much more vulnerable in a context where class and caste still matter a great deal. Having said that, it's not a very pretty picture in Pakistan. Let me also conclude by saying one thing. For a Muslim, a practicing Muslim, a liberal Muslim, a fundamentalist Muslim, a secular Muslim, the question of the personhood, sacredness of the Prophet Muhammad is a very sensitive issue, extremely sensitive. Very few people outside the fold of Islam can understand and appreciate the depth of love and passion for Prophet Muhammad that Muslims do have. There is a Persian saying, Ba Khuda Diwana Bashat, Ba Muhammad Hoshyar. You can take liberties with God, but be careful with Muhammad. Be careful with Muhammad. It's a sensitive issue for Muslims. That's why a drone kills about 60 people in North Waziristan. An Al-Qaeda-inspired Sunni kill about 120 Shiite Muslims in Karbala, in Najaf, in Iraq. Well, people say, bad, too bad. But nothing much happens. A profanity occurs against Prophet Muhammad. Somebody sketches a cartoon of Prophet Muhammad. The entire Muslim world rises up. Is it irrational? I don't know. For many outsiders, it's totally irrational. You don't care the lives of 200 people, 120 people killed there, and somebody sketches a cartoon mocking your prophet, and look at what you do, Salman Rushdie and all these things. What? I can't explain that. I feel the same way. I'm not a very good practicing Muslim. If somebody utters a nasty word about Prophet Muhammad, I'm a very peaceful person. I've never touched a gun in my whole life. Never touched it. Any kind of gun.
What kind of American are you?
Oh, that's why. Yeah. But at least I would feel like using my fist if somebody says something nasty about the Prophet. Having said that, that does not mean that a Muslim country like Pakistan should create an environment of scare, not only for the non-Muslims, but for Muslims and for everybody, in the name of defending the name of Prophet. Umid Safi, a very good friend of mine, and a fine scholar who teaches at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, he has a blog, and he says, what Muhammad would do. What would Muhammad do? and he comments on developments in the Muslim world and in various other places in the world. As I say, what would Jesus do, right? He said, what would Muhammad do? When this Muhammad cartoon came up, when this movie against Prophet Muhammad was shown, that step, and yeah, what would Muhammad do? And he said, he would just smile and look the other way, and he would pray, say that, oh God, give this man guidance. Wallah alam bisawa. God knows the best. Thank you very much.
We would like to open up our conversation with Kumtas.
I would. So if somebody got a hold of this paper, you could be in trouble.
One good thing about two things, yes or no. I have been saying these things in Pakistan. It's not that I have said these things here in Canada and I would say things differently in Pakistan. However, I would probably be a little careful in the way I put them. Even I would say these things in my own university, which is International Islamic University. And my current president is from Saudi Arabia. And he's a Wahhabi. Salafi. Okay? There's no doubt that the public space for critical Islamic thinking has been restricted in Pakistan over the years. Having said that, there are people, and I'm not one of those very brave people, there are other people who are using whatever space is available to raise their voices. If you look at the Pakistani press, who are the people who are writing against the blasphemy laws? People writing in the English press, in the Urdu press, look at the columns, newspaper columns. Take English Daily Dawn from Karachi. I mean, the most outspoken critic of these religious discriminations and protection of the discriminations against the minorities, against the blasphemy laws. Some of the what I would consider neo-traditionalist Islamic scholars are raising their voices. There's one very popular religious scholar, popular electronically speaking. He shows up on television programs. Javed Ahmed Ghamidi, he has been writing openly from within the Islamic tradition, arguing from within Islam against the blasphemy laws. There are others who are doing this in Pakistan. So I don't think I'll be in much trouble in Pakistan. Probably some of the Orthodox ulama will not like my argument. But then from within the Orthodox ulama, I know there's one Deobandi scholar. His name is Maulana Zahidur Rashti. He's a very Orthodox, typical Deobandi school scholar. His son, whose name is Ammar, writes in the journal of his own father, criticizing his father on the issue of blasphemy. And he has published a book.
I was wondering if there was within the ulama a variety of perspectives. I mean, surely some of them must see this curious way in which this is working and understand how unhealthy that is for the judiciary, as well as the society, as well as the understanding of Islam. Mm-hmm.
Privately, I think there are not many, but I have talked to some of the ulama. Privately, they would admit, well, there are loopholes in this law. This law has been abused and misused. And it has created an atmosphere of great insecurity for the, not only for the religious minorities, but even for Muslims, because most of the cases have been filed against the Muslims, not against non-Muslims. However, for somebody to go in public, he won't do that. Unless, I mean, all the ulama, they take up a question, because he will be singled out.
Yeah.
So that's one problem. And secondly, he will tell me, well, you, for example, when he talks about this law has been abused. And the usual argument is, well, which law has not been abused? All laws in Pakistan are being abused. So would you like to abolish all laws? There are so many people who are innocent and they are sent in jail because of the corruption of the judicial system in Pakistan. So should we abolish laws against theft and stealing and breach of contract? So this is the kind of argument that come up. And then they say, well, the whole idea is to prevent disruption of society. The whole idea is not to let people hurt religious feelings of the other. And I would also always ask them the question, okay, these laws were, for example, the blasphemy law, the so-called 295C was introduced in 1980s and 1990s. How many cases of insulting the Prophet took place before these laws were passed? None. We never heard of any. So, why there was a need for it? It's not every day that somebody would say, why anybody would do it? But, I mean, it's simply ununderstandable in a country like Pakistan. 96% of the population is Muslim. Why would anybody do it? For God's sake, what is the need of it? It's a typical American thing in the United States. One single incident happens. For example, let's say, this is Samsung, a dog eats Samsung cell phone, and immediately the Congress would pass a law that henceforth no dog will be allowed 10 feet within the distance of 10 feet of a Samsung cell phone. This is typical America. One single incident happens, immediately they pass a law for that. And that incident probably will never happen for the next 100 years. That's what happened in Pakistan. Yes?
From their perspective,
we could be the victims.
Yeah. You see, the problem is that the fact remains that overwhelming majority of the people who have been so far accused of blasphemy are Muslims, no doubt about it. Okay, as the data clearly shows. If you take out the Ahmadis, which were the basic target of all these laws, let's admit that. The Christians didn't matter at all at that. It was specifically targeted against the Ahmadis, and it was a political move. Okay. And then now it's a kind of white net. Everybody is coming under that. The Muslims who are accused of this thing, mostly they are the poor people. Okay. And it's not probably, it's only about 0.1001%. that a person has been accused legitimately for doing something. It's always on personal account, personal vendetta. So when that is the issue, then your religious identity is not an issue. If I have a dispute with you, it doesn't matter whether you're a Christian or an Ahmadi or a Muslim. One guy in Gujranwala, remember, he was a member, a full member of the Jamaat-e-Islami, which is the most fundamentalist political party of Pakistan. His name was Muhammad Iqbal, a medical doctor, a physician. and no Hafize Quran. He had memorized the Quran by heart. A pious Muslim. He was lynched by the mob outside his home on the charges of burning the pages of Quran. He's a Hafiz of Quran. Why? Religious reasons? No. The people who did to him had a land dispute and they lost the case in the court. Then they lost the case in the higher court and then they lost the case in the Supreme Court and they were so upset that they staged this drama, threw the burnt pages of the Quran and then collected a mob and they brought him outside and said, lynched him. Now, there's an outrage. Okay? There's an outrage in the community after that. Oh, but so it's just an outrage like the old Egyptians would do it. In the ancient Egypt when somebody would some woman who would claim to have some supernatural powers and in order to see whether her supernatural powers came from good spirits or from demons, they would tie her up and throw her in the Nile river. If she would drown, and they would say, well, yes, she had her supernatural powers from good spirits. And if she would survive, they would take her out and kill her, say that she was a demon. So in both cases, you have expressed your sympathy, but then you are dead. And the other thing is, then the mullahs, the religious leaders, they would come, said, well, this guy deserved it because he defiled the name of the Prophet.
It's the average person might think that, you know, like they're just saying, they came for the Jews, they came for this, and when they came for me, there was nobody left to talk. You talk on my behalf. If the average person kind of thinks, I am equally likely, because it's only been them.
I think this is a good argument, and I hope that this will prevail one day. I mean, if these things keep on happening again and again, innocent people are lynched and tried, or they languish in jail and they keep committing suicides, and all these issues and cases are highlighted in the media and the press, which is now taking place. One thing I should have said in my presentation is that the newly independent media in Pakistan is doing a great deal of service in terms of reporting these cases. The case of Misha, for example, the poor girl would have been destroyed if immediately the private relevant channels would not have highlighted her tragedy. So, if these things are kept on being highlighted, I think soon a time will come when everybody will think, well, tomorrow it will be my turn, so let's do something about it. Once the public opinion is prepared, then that's why I said for the time being, I don't see any move for the repeal of such laws. What we can expect at the maximum is some amendments to bring some sanity into the present law and then hope for its eventual repeal. Yes.
It seems to be inordinately easy to mobilize mob violence.
Yes.
Where is that coming from?
Well, yeah. In the Pakistani context, there's a great deal of what you call the emotionally, religiously charged kind of resource that is easily exploited by the religious clergy. There's one slogan that carries a great deal of weight. Islam is in danger. Islam khatre mein hai. And they are going to get you. they? Who are they? The Jews, the Christians, the Indians, the Hindus, the enemies of Islam, the conspiracies, whatever, the world, something like that. Okay? And once you create this siege kind of mentality with your rhetoric and continuous rhetoric, then it is much easier to exploit the sentiments of the people. Then there are certain situations in which people are made to realize that everything is not myth or fiction. There are certain things that are happening around the world that are intended to cause harms to Muslims. When you talk to the ulama, for example, and they say, well, we're not saying just one nothing. Look what is happening. The Muslims are in trouble everywhere in the world. Look what's happening in Palestine, in Kashmir, in Chechnya, in Bosnia, in this place and that place. And look, Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, in Iraq. The world powers are doing this to us and doing this. The Jews are doing this. The Indians are killing Muslims in India. All these conspiracies of the world. And then you create this kind of a scary situation in which it becomes much easier to exploit it. Then suddenly you have Danish cartoons, you have Terry Jones burning the Quran in the United States. Then you have somebody producing a movie against Prophet Muhammad, and then you have some stupid statements coming about people like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and other evangelicals and all these things, and you can make up a whole big conspiracy out of it. That's what they do.
I understand that, but it still is a bit peculiar, because when you think, what could be more blasphemous than to suggest that human beings have to save God?
Yeah.
I mean, that seems to me like the ultimate form of blasphemy out of the heart of the tradition.
Exactly, yeah.
Certainly within the Christian tradition, anytime human beings have decided to save God, we've got a new heresy that's developed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, yeah. This consciousness has to come about in order to convince the people to make sane decisions in these respects. And there have been instances recently, for example, when this Christian neighborhood was set on fire in Lahore near the auto market, and that happened at the middle of the night. The next day, there were about 60, 65 people that were severely injured, and some of them had to jump to save their lives because the lower ground level was burning, so many of them were injured. And next day there were probably 300 people line up to donate blood, and all of them were Muslims.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you have on the other end this thing, but unfortunately this phenomenon of some kind of very charged religious environment at the popular level that has been created by the religious clergy, it's very dangerous in Pakistan. Hopefully, my feeling. And you see, this is not an isolated phenomenon. I mean, all these things are related. As far as I'm concerned, as a student of political science, everything goes back to the early 1980s. Afghan jihad. That is the mother and father of all the troubles. The rise of Islamic fundamentalism, Islamic extremism, Islamic militancy, terrorism. And then when we seek the answer, we shouldn't look only Pharaoh answers, look towards Tehran or Islamabad or Riyadh. We should also look towards Langley, Virginia.
And to Cold War, you have the rise of Cold War.
Exactly.
You have the old half, you have the Salafis, Saudis.
Exactly. All the nexus. Yeah.
The strongest part of your argument is that everything is very much political.
Exactly. And it's not only 1980s, after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, December 1917, yeah. Right? That's when the Soviet troops entered. But let's go back to the 1950s, yeah. During the early period of the Cold War. Who were the collaborators of the Western powers in the Muslim world? The Muslim Brotherhood. In Egypt, in Sudan, in Saudi Arabia, and in Gulf State. At those days, there were no Gulf States, the British were still there. But in order to fight against the atheist communism, the United States and the Western countries reached out to the Muslim fundamentalists, to the Muslim Brotherhood, which now is considered to be kind of radical and all these things, that all these Al-Qaeda and Takfir wal-Hijra and Ansar al-Mujahideen and all these people, they are offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood. They were our closest allies. We were funding them against Nasser, President Nasser of Egypt. We are funding them against the so-called Arab nationalist socialist forces. So it's a long story of alliance between a fundamentalist Salafi Wahhabi Islam and the Western powers. Then it becomes too obvious and too close embrace in 1979 when the Soviets invaded. What happens in 1979? The Iranian Revolution, Islamic Revolution in Iran. And then suddenly there's a scare of Shia Islam. Shias are bad Muslims, right? Because they are chanting the slogan, Deaths to America. Right. Suddenly the Sunnis in Afghanistan take up the arms against the Soviets. So Sunnis are good Muslims because they are fighting the communists. So we start supporting the Sunnis. Okay? But Shias are bad Muslims, Sunnis are good Muslims, Sunnis are our Islamic fundamentalists, right? Brzezinski said that there are two kind of fundamentalists, good fundamentalists and bad fundamentalists. So they were our fundamentalists. Osama bin Laden was one of them. Okay? We asked the Egyptians, we asked the Saudis. The Saudis were not the first one. The Americans were the ones who put pressure on the Saudis, give money to these. Okay? We'll give them training, we'll give them weapons, you give them the money. We paid to Sadat, President Sadat, and Sadat delivered the Russian weaponry to the Afghan Mujahideen. This is what the game in the town was. And then you raise a whole generation of jihadis, Islamic militants. This was the first time, probably during the past 300 years of Islamic history, that an international Islamic force was assembled. It never happened during the past 300 years. And under the auspices of the CIA, an Islamic international force like the Communist International was created. Who were fighting in Afghanistan? The Kuwaitis, the Saudis, right? The Egyptians, the Moroccans, the Indonesians, from Thailand, from Philippines, of course from Pakistan, and from India, from Bangladesh, and from America. In New York, I was there in New York. I went for a fundraising. A friend of mine invited, Farhan Afghan, where I was told that Sheikh Umar Abdurrahman, the blind cleric who is now in jail, he was given an office by the CIA in Brooklyn, New York, to do the recruitment on behalf of the CIA for the Afghan Mujahideen.
They were doing the same
in Syria. And who were his main targets? The African American Muslims, the black Muslims. Because they thought that the Egyptian cleric was much popular among the blacks, so He was brought in there. No, he's in the jail. Today, as I was telling David, we are doing exactly the same, playing the same game in Syria. What does that mean? We are creating a third generation of jihadis. We have not suffered yet. Aren't we learning any lessons from our past mistakes? But then you go about it. Remember, I will quote Brzezinski after the tragedy of 9/11. He appeared on one of the CNN programs, and he was asked the question. He was asked, looking at what happened on 9/11, don't you think you made a mistake by supporting those Mujahideen in Afghanistan? And he said, if I'm given the chance, I'll do it again. What are you talking about? Because what we achieved by supporting the Mujahideen is a history-making event. Collapse of the Soviet Union, the greatest event of the 20th century. These Mujahideen are small change. I'll do it again. So, in my interpretation, they are making a stupid mistake. Probably in their own thinking, they are playing a big strategic game by repeating the same thing in Syria. I don't know what historical.
Do you have any of that in writing that you just said? Because I have a lot of American and Canadian friends that are beginning to get brainwashed against the Muslim religion. And I would like to have some kind of reference material to point them to and say, look, as you reap what you sow, it looks like what you're saying.
Dale, I can send to David some of the things that have been published by other people and some of my ramblings also on this. But certainly I would be very happy to then request him to pass it on to you. Yeah, but unfortunately, it was Mustafa, he's responsible for what I said. because he took me on this track. Which is that what is happening today in Pakistan, whether we are talking about domestic politics, even such thing as blasphemy law, this thing, we have to look at within the broader picture. And that picture has a history going back to the 1950s, 1980s. And then, of course, look at Syrian situation. Okay. In Syria, we are supporting the rebels and opposing the government, right? In Iraq, we are supporting the government and opposing the rebels, right? Okay, understandable, rational, no problem. But in Iraq, we are fighting against the Sunni rebels, right? We are opposing the Sunni rebels. In Syria, we are supporting the Sunni rebels. This is what amazes us. And you seem like thinking, what's happening?
In Iraq, we are against Al Qaeda. In Syria, we support Al Qaeda.
We support Al Qaeda.
So there's a good Al Qaeda.
There's a bad Al Qaeda. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you'll be taking a bit of this on tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.